for the energy.
Today is Monday. About 20 minutes today. Yeah, but I'm talking, and I'm the chair today, not you.
Ouch.
You can say that to me tomorrow. Today's Monday, April 3rd, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee.
I thought you were going to say April Fool.
No.
Because it's not. That was 2 days ago. Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on Human Services, and today we'll be continuing the public hearing on Senate Bill 5526, Department of Human Services, focusing now on the first of 2 days about child welfare. Ms. Barley, anything we should be thinking about?
Yeah, put your materials on Ellis, and the agency is here to start the conversation.
All right, Ms. Al-Husseini, Mr. Saiki, whoever else is coming up to join us, Ms. Brickman.
Good morning.
So, Chair Rayfield and Chair Steiner-Hewer, members of the committee, for the record, Clyde Saiki, Department of Human Services. With me at the table is our Child Welfare Director, Lena Al-Husseini, and Ms. Brinkman from the Chief Financial Office. And we're here today to make a presentation on our child welfare program. So, Lena has been the director of our child welfare program since November of 2016, just a little under 5 months. Just to disclose, as we were going through the interview process, I was very open and honest with her and told her exactly kind of what she was getting into, and she so graciously accepted the position. Lena has a long background of working with children and child protective issues. She established the first child protective protection center in the Middle East, and she has worked on children's issues at the global level, actually, with such organizations as USAID, UNICEF, and the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Just before joining us, Lena served as the executive director of the Arab American Family Support Center in New York. And in 2011, President Obama honored Lena as a White House champion of change for her work in child protection, domestic violence, and sex trafficking. She brings 20 years of leadership experience in areas of international development, child protection services, social services, and behavioral health. Lena's a very quick study. But again, she's been here for just under 5 months, so I have asked her to bring some of her staff people, some who are in the room and some who will be joining us later today and even tomorrow, to help with any questions that you may have. And with that, I'll turn it over to Lena.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Saiki.
Thank you, Director Saiki. Chair Steiner-Hewert, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lena Al-Husseini, and thank you. Today is my first Ways and Means. So you have to excuse me if I make any mistakes.
No worries. We're pretty patient about this.
So the presentation today, we're going to go through our mission and goals, basically who our constituents are, who we serve, an overview, a very broad overview of our services, our priorities for the next year. Tomorrow we'll go through a little bit of a budget overview and the key performance measures. Our mission, number one, is to keep children in Oregon safe and to provide safe and appropriate placements for all our children, especially those that cannot be safe in their homes. Our goals and operating principles. Again, safety for all Oregonian children, to engage communities and partners to better support children and families. And communities, we mean local community at the grassroots level as well, so communities all across. To ensure equity and to respect cultural differences, and recruit and support foster parents and partners. This is just a broad overview. This is just capturing one day in the life of child welfare almost. In 2016, a total of 11,191 children spent at least one day in some type of foster care. Of those, 76,668 were reports of abuse and neglect. That's the total number of reports that we got. last year. Out of those, we had 37,320 completed investigations, and out of those, there were 11,843 founded victims, basically. Of those, and I just want to give, this number about INCARE does not represent this proportionality. It just gives you the number of children we had versus the population. So in care, 70% of our children were white Caucasian, 16% Hispanic, 6% Black, 5% American Indian, and 1% Asian Pacific Islander. Our children are very young, more than around 46.3% are younger than 6. So very vulnerable children are in our care. Of those, the 43.5% of our children have their parents have substance abuse problems. So a lot of it is addiction. Of those, well, now we're moving to, at the moment, we have 3,881 certified foster homes. That's a live number, so every day it changes a little bit. So this was taken, I believe, last month. This year we've had 748 children adopted and 282 children exited foster care to a guardianship. This is an overview of child welfare services. We're divided this way to match up with the Children's Bureau, how they evaluate our work. So safety is CPS and differential response. Both of these use the Oregon safety model. Half of the state is currently using differential response. Half of it is using our traditional CPS. The well-being includes foster care, treatment services, which is our BRS providers, independent living programs, and I'll go into all of these later, health and wellness program, and the homeless and runaway youth. And permanency includes adoption, guardianship services, Title IV E waiver, which is a life program, which I'll speak about also later in this presentation, post-adoption services, and the interstate compact. Each of these I will be discussing later. Child protective services. As you can see, our numbers have stayed more or less level between 2014 to 2016, with a slight increase in 2016. In 2014, as you can tell, we had 67,863 calls. And in 2016, we had 76,668 calls. But the numbers are more or less, you know, the same kind of increase. 10,000 more calls, 10,000 more investigations, and a little bit more founded.
Ms. Al-Husseini, I don't know enough to know whether this is really significant or not, but if you look at the difference between 14 and 15, you're looking about an increase of just under 2,000, whereas when you go from 15 to 16, you're looking at an increase of 8,000, 7,000 or 8,000, which is a much bigger percentage. I mean, that does not seem consistent with the increase that we saw between 14 and 15. Do we have any sense as to why that? To me, that does seem like a big difference, but maybe I don't understand the data well enough.
I mean,
no, go ahead.
I was going to say, I mean, for me, whenever the numbers increase, it means we're finding, we're doing our job better because more people are calling in. But I can.
So, Chair Steiner, here, we're Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. I'm not 100% sure why the increase happened, but one of the factors, I think, and we can verify this with you, is that for a long period of time, we were behind on our assessments. And we made a really concerted effort to catch up in 2016. And I think that's why, at least on not so much for the calls, but for the other numbers we
right.
saw an increase.
Now that makes sense, and
yeah.
I appreciate that. That's good to see. It's the number of calls, and it could well be. I mean, people talk about, you know, increased prevalence of domestic violence or child abuse, and I would argue pretty strongly that that's because people are more willing to report it now than they used to be. And it may be that that's exactly what we're seeing here. People are more willing to call in.
Senator Winters.
One of the other factors is probably, it could be that, you know, there's been a lot of media attention directed at the agency, and we find that when that occurs, you'll get an increase in the number of contacts coming into the agency. And over the last several, you know, few years, there was a lot of media attention out of the Oregonian and, mm-hmm. and for some of the cases, high-profile cases.
Okay. Senator Steiner, Hayward, Senator Winters, members of the committee, I would agree. I mean, the more calls you see coming in, it means the more successful we have been in reaching people as well.
Great. Thank you,
Madam Chair.
So, in the numbers are founded, since in 2014 we stopped kind of going to a disposition in differential response, how do we compare apples to apples what's been founded versus what's been in investigated, if you've got that whole, so like in 2015 there were about 2,800 that went the alternative response route. If none of those come to a disposition of founded or unfounded, how do we know how that fits into this data, and wouldn't that tell us that the actual number of victims is higher than what's demonstrated by founded?
Senator Steiner Hayward, Senator Rayfield, members of the committee, Senator Gelser. Excuse me. In 2014, we just started differential response. In 2015, less than a third, I would imagine, of the state, is it a third, was on differential response. In 2016, half of the state was on differential response. Both tracks have an assessment. And of both tracks that have assessment, then you're going to get the, you know, after the assessment, you get the founded, right? So I'm not sure I understand your question.
Sure. I think the question is, since one of the key elements of differential response is that you don't do a disposition of founded, unfounded, or unable to determine, for like in 2015, the 2,800 that were in that alternative response, or whatever number, so half the state in 2016, about 60%, those wouldn't have a disposition of founded because you don't do a disposition in alternative response. So the question is, how do we track how many kids are victimized of those that have been called in and assessed if we've now taken a whole chunk of those, because we do the assessment, but there isn't a disposition of founded or unfounded?
So, Chair Steiner Hayward, okay. With your indulgence, this was one of the reasons we brought mm-hmm. Staff in, given Ms. Al-Husseini's short tenure and my limited or just enough to be dangerous knowledge of
actually, we always value when areas. We always value when agencies bring in the people who really know
right.
what they're talking
so
about.
I'm going to ask Stacey Lake, who's our DR manager, to come up and answer
Welcome,
that.
Welcome, Ms. Lake, please.
Thank you. My name is Stacey Lake, for the record. Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Gelser, representatives of the committee. Senator Gelser, you're correct. We do not have dispositions on those cases that are assigned to what's called the alternative response. And what we have found pretty consistently through our 2.5 years of implementation is about half of the cases in the differential response counties are assigned to alternative response. So those cases would end with no disposition at all. So certainly no founded. I recognize that those traditional response cases may also not end in founded. They may end in unfounded or unable to determine, but they would have a disposition. Now, out of the half of the cases that are assigned alternative response, between about 10 to 15% also switch to traditional response, so those would also end in founded reports.
Ms. Lake?
I'm sorry.
Thank you. And I just still, the question really, though, was how do we... If we have this whole body of work where we're not doing dispositions and we have this metric, which is a really important measurement, mm-hmm. how is the department measuring the number of children that are victims if we can't compare year over year? What percentage of investigations end in a founded?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Senator Gelser, one of the ways that we're looking at our system differently since we started differential response with the help of the University of Illinois, who's doing our external evaluation, is we're also looking at re-reports as an important safety indicator. That's kind of how many of the other states have changed how they look at their system, because we are, you're right, you can't continue to compare as your implementation gets further and further, and once you get to a statewide number, it's hard to look at a system that is currently doing differential response, compare that to a system that wasn't, you know, even 5 years earlier. So that's part of why we also look at re-reports down the road, so that we can be comparing those.
Thank you.
So then let me clarify one other thing, Ms. Lake, if I could. Even cases that end up on the alternative response track do fall under the metric of completed investigations. Is that correct?
Chair Steiner-Hayward, that is correct.
Okay, so we may not be able to compare the founded or unfounded or no determination possible metric, but we can compare the percent that were investigated, things like that.
That is correct.
Okay. And then, Mr. Psyche, just to circle back from it, you commented on the effort that the agency had made in 2016 to complete more investigations, which is great. Is that so? If I look, the comment at the bottom of the slide says DHS does not investigate every slide that comes in, only those that rise to the level of abuse or neglect, which is interesting to think about how you determine that from a phone call, but or other report without doing an investigation. But so the 37,000 plus that we see completed investigations doesn't necessarily mean that there were more of those calls, a higher percentage that represented abuse and neglect. It just simply means that you were able to actually evaluate a higher percentage of the calls that you had concerns about?
So I think we evaluated every call. I'm going to let Stacy answer.
Sure.
Chair Steiner-Hayward, you are correct. The number of calls went up. The number of those assigned went up. I'm sorry. I'm not sure if I'm answering your question.
I guess all I'm saying is that if you look at 2015, there were completed investigations on maybe 40%. I'm doing rough math, at a little under about 40% of the total calls. And in 2016, you're looking at more like 50%. And it doesn't mean that you all thought that more of the calls, a higher percentage of the calls you got actually warranted an investigation. It means that you were actually able to complete the investigations on a higher percentage of those that you thought warranted investigation.
Chair Steiner-Hayward, I would say that's an accurate assessment.
Okay. Madam Chair, can I ask a clarification?
Sure.
So, and for some of those reports, going back to what Director Psyche said a minute ago, in 2016, I know Dr. Richardson had really reprioritized work.
Absolutely.
Because there were thousands of incomplete assessments stretching back to 15 and 14. So are some of those 37,320 based on calls that actually came in prior years rather than calls? And so the assessments,
yeah,
are they necessarily in the same year as the hotline call?
So
Senator Steiner, Chair Steiner-Hayward, Senator Gelser, I believe they are, because I believe the push for the overdue assessments happened in July and August, so that would make it within the same year. Is that accurate?
Chair Steiner-Hayward, Senator Gelser, I'm not sure. I don't want to go on the record if I'm not sure. And so I can loop back with Dr. Richardson, and we can get the answer back to you and bring it back tomorrow.
Could you also provide for the committee, please, when you provide answers, if you look back at the metric that I see that's missing here is, in the best of all possible worlds, if you had all the staffing anybody could possibly want, what percentage of the calls in 2014, 15, and 16 would you have thought warranted an investigation? Because if you're telling me that all the calls that we got in 2016 that warranted an investigation got one and it was completed, okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a happy woman. But if you're telling me that that didn't happen, then I need to understand a little bit more about that.
Sure.
And how you prioritize, because obviously one would hope that, you know, and how do you make that I think there's a little bit of written description about that and how the you make decisions. Just
I don't want to go into it in too much detail here,
sure,
but I would
sure.
like to understand yeah. a little bit more, if the committee would, about how those decisions are made. Representative Buehler.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Yeah, my concern is, by looking at, are we having nearly 40,000 hotline calls that are not being investigated in any way? And are those 76,000 and change, are those unique calls about individual children, or are there multiple calls about the same kid?
Chair Steiner, Hayward, Representative Buehler. I actually asked that question, so I know how to answer. Some of these are duplicates. Sometimes we get a number of calls for the same instance. People heard or saw something. A few people do call. Some of these apparently don't rise to that level. So, for instance, somebody yelling at a child doesn't quite rise up to the child abuse determination. We are going to have Stacey Ayers, who's our CPS manager, later today. So he might be able to answer some of these questions, or if he's too late, maybe tomorrow. So,
okay. Thank you. Thank you for detailed answers.
Actually, we might
need you. We can always pull Ms. Brickman back if we need her, but you right now, I think, are important as well.
As you all know, in Oregon, we had been implementing a rollout of differential response since late 2014. In 2016, that was put on hold, I believe, in September.
May,
I'm sorry. It was put on hold in May. And part of the reason it was put on hold is because we wanted to evaluate, since half of the state was already differential response, we wanted to evaluate how successful differential response has been. What are the issues that we have, and should we continue with differential response or not? So after looking at all the metrics and evaluating all the different information that we have and consulting with many of our partners like the Casey Foundation and ACF and the Children's Bureau, I've decided to go ahead with differential response. Currently, differential response is in half of our districts currently. My recommendation is that we continue the rollout of differential response. I think around 25 states in the United States are currently using differential response. Is it 24 or 25? And correct me if I'm wrong. I think Oregon I think we can stop and take a look at what we're doing now, make a few tweaks. I think we've been able to identify some issues with our differential response, the way it was implemented. So I think this is an opportunity for us to look and to evaluate, to tweak, and to roll it back again.
So Chair Steiner Hayward, members of the committee, you know, we've had a lot of discussion about this topic area over the last few months, and it's a very serious, we've had some very serious discussion. So in discussing this with Director El-Husseini, there are several things I asked her and told her. And the first one is, in looking at some of the data and analysis that we've done, we know that in some areas we have some practice and implementation issues. And so what I asked her to do is, number one, to make sure that we're going back to those areas and really shoring up either through training or whatever means necessary so that we are responding appropriately and making sure that we're assigning cases properly. The second thing I told her is that until we get a degree of comfort that it's working in the counties we've already implemented in, I don't want to implement it in any new counties. And before we implement it in new counties, I want her and his staff to do an assessment of those new counties to judge their readiness to be able to implement that in those counties. And those are two things I feel very strongly about in direction I want her to take. She's also engaged the Casey Foundation to help her in both those efforts, and also had our federal partners from the Administration for Children and Families offer their assistance and their help and their support in getting those two things done. But you know, I will go on record as saying we have some issues that we need to deal with. And if we truly are committed to safety for children, we have to deal with those issues, and we have to correct those issues as quickly as possible and not roll it out any further until we're comfortable or confident that the counties are ready to have it implemented in their county.
Thank you. And I'll be with you in one sec, Senator Gilster. Thank you for saying that. I appreciate it, and I appreciate your awareness that we need to do some rethinking. We have a lot of great people in this committee, many of whom are new either to the legislature entirely or to this committee in particular. This is such a complicated issue that I think if Ms. Lake or Mr. Ayers or somebody would be willing to provide a couple of page summary for the committee about differential response and how it does in fact differ and what the requirements are for participation and how that happens. I think that would be very helpful to the committee to understand this so that they can read through it at their leisure and then circle back with you with any questions. I know that there have been, I have held myself some misconceptions that I've learned a lot about this year. So it would be helpful if you'd be willing to persuade.
I need to go to another committee, but I do understand differential response and what you're attempting to do, and it's a very short period of time to actually, when we talk about assessments and an evaluation of a program, 2 years is not a long time, actually. But I do want to stress that training has to be at the heart of what you're doing in order to get your workers and your supervisors on board and to make certain that the system actually is geared. So I really appreciate Director Psyche that you're going to take those steps in order to get there. So I need to go. Apologies.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Steiner, Herbert, Chair Rayfield. Differential response differs from the traditional CPS models in that after assessment, if it's medium to low risk, we involve community partners. So a lot of it really is working with community partners and working with the families to help them go over the challenges that they are facing, if it's deemed the safe way to go. A lot of 10 to 15% of the cases change track. But what I'd like to suggest, if you don't mind, for the next slide, we're going to be talking about differential response. Before the next slide, maybe I can ask Stacey Lake to give a very high-level description of the differences, if you don't mind.
Sure. Senator Gilster, do you want to ask a question before we get there?
I wanted to thank Dr. Psyche for the comments about pausing the expansion. I just wondered if there's any discussion at all about pausing the practice, given the significant concerns raised by district attorneys, defense attorneys, CASAs, medical directors, staff, and child advocates around the state about what's happening to kids in differential response counties. Why continue with something where there's questions rather than pause across the board?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Senator Gilster, I think that's a great question, and really have appreciated your engagement on this issue. So, I think when you take an overall look at it, we have a lot of people who have raised concerns about it, but I will tell you I've had a lot of people also come to us, the tribes, and our federal partners and other people and members of the community and foster families and families that who have had engagement with our system, who have said that this has worked for them and that it's working for them. And so I think, where I'm sitting, I'm hearing kind of both sides of the story, where I definitely hear people who have concerns, but I also hear from people who say it's working, it's worked for us, this was a good solution. And so I have to kind of help Ms. Al-Husseini make an evaluation of, given that we're hearing two schools of thought, how do we sort that all out? I will tell you that, at your hearing a week ago Monday, and as we talked about an evaluation that our consultants have done, and I think there was 45 cases out of 101 reviewed where we had concerns. So I asked our consultants to go back, because after that meeting, I wanted to make sure, if nothing else, that we had eyes on the families and the kids, those 45 families and kids, to make sure that they were safe and that we didn't have an ongoing issue. And again, in looking at the data, and I'd be happy to share it once it's finalized, you know, there were a number of those cases where, although the consultant disagreed with the caseworker on what the determination was, when the consultants went back and followed up with the caseworker, you know, they found that the families were doing okay and were, they didn't feel the kids were in danger. And that, this was a dialogue between the caseworker and the consultant. And so for me, one of the things we have to do is, we have consultants in every district in the state, and we have consultants in central office. And what I've asked Stacey Ayers and Tammy to do is to really, on an ongoing basis, continue to evaluate and take a look at these cases to make sure we're making the right determination, and to open up a dialogue with people in the branch, because I think when you talk about training, the best training we can do for our staff is to actually staff actual cases and say, tell me what the case was, tell me how you made your decision. Okay, so did you think about this? Or maybe that might not be the right decision and we need to go another route. And so that's kind of, when I talk about training and talk about supporting our staff, part of the work we have to do. And this has actually, I think, created an opportunity to really open up that dialogue and staff cases that are going to the alternative response route, so we make sure that you know, the right decisions are being made. And I'll be honest with you, and you know this, training is an ongoing issue for us because of our turnover rate. You know, you don't become a CPS worker overnight. It takes a while, and so I think it's incumbent on us to really provide that support system and get people they can call on and rely on and staff cases with, so we're making the right decisions. But, you know, my commitment is that we are going to shore up what we're doing in those counties where we already have the system in place, and we're not going to roll it out to any new counties until we do an assessment and we're positive, or as sure as we can be, that staff are ready to do that. But in the counties where we do have the system in place, training, staffing of cases with consultants, and that ongoing support is the number one priority.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think about time here. I think we may well end up coming back to some of these issues in phase two. So to perhaps, if it's okay with you, to ensure that we get through the bulk of this,
sure.
If we're really efficient and we have some time at the end of the day tomorrow, we could ask Ms. Right. Lake for indulgence to come back. And if not, then if we can consider bringing this back. But a written description, Ms. Lake, would be very helpful to the committee. So if that's okay with you right now, I think I want to keep us moving. Coach
Rayfield. One of the things I think might be interesting in the differential response that often isn't talked about in the numbers that I'd personally like to hear is the component of when a family allows, you know, you don't have enough to remove the child, so they move, and the subset of the families that voluntarily move into differential response, of those families where when the CPS workers out there, they don't find enough later on because of that interaction, they eventually do find enough facts to then later remove, which increases the safety for the children later mm-hmm. on, where otherwise without differential response, DHS wouldn't even have been in those lives. I'd like to find that, you know, because so that increases safety in kind of a long-term perspective with the differential response. So I'd like to kind of see how often does mm-hmm. that happen? I think that would be real interesting to look at too.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Reif, and members of the committee, we can provide that data for you. We can also give you the data in terms of certs between DR and non-DR yeah. and sensitive issues, so you can sort of gauge, and we can give you some data from our work in differential response. And I'm going to go in the next slide and talk a little bit more about that. Sorry, I saw.
Thank you.
Ask, yeah.
All right. Sorry, Representative Dealer.
Yeah, another question about differential response. Do you have expectations on the amount of time that it should take to resolve a response?
Yes, Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller. Our rules and procedures allow us up to 45 days to complete a CPS assessment in those counties practicing DR. And in the counties not practicing DR, it remained at the 30 days until they implement DR. We allowed for a little bit of extra time in the counties practicing DR because we introduced a new process that takes approximately 2 weeks that involves the community. So I can go into some more detail tomorrow morning about that.
Thank you. And what percentage are actually being resolved within that time?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Representative Bueller, we do have that information. I don't have that off the top of my head. It's not nearly as many as it should be that we are completing timely, but I will be able to provide that tomorrow, if that's all right.
Thank you.
Please.
So we're going to talk in very overview on differential response. Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair members of the committee. I acknowledge there are concerns about differential response. So I'll just go through these. Basically, what we feel differential response offers Oregon, there more children will be safely at home with their parents. And there's many cases, and you've seen a lot of our children are very young, a lot of our issues, many of them are addiction and other issues. So there are supports to families who are struggling with these challenges rather than removal of the children. There would be, according to all the data nationally, in 4 to 6 years, there would be an expectation that there would be fewer children in foster care. It partners with families. One of the things I really like about it, it provides a safety net for families. It helps families through the struggle. It keeps an eye on the children as the family is learning new skills, getting the support that they need. But hopefully it ends as well with the child being safe at home with their family. So that's one of the reasons I'm recommending we go ahead with it. It reduces disproportionality. There's an issue already with disproportionality in Oregon. Differential response has been seen, and I can provide research as well, to reduce disproportionality. Through the community partnership, it offers families culturally responsive services that from the community, by the community, to the community. So it really sort of targets families exactly how they, you know, within their cultural makeup, within their cultural background. It has been seen nationally to reduce re-reports, and it has been seen nationally to reduce abuse. And we were going to talk a little bit, Stacey was going to provide a high-level overview later on. But differential response, the difference is really it engages community partnerships. The way it's been done in Oregon, it's a little bit different from how I'm used to, which is in our case you have to have mandated community partnerships, in New York, I mean, versus Oregon. But some of the things we're looking at is looking at the way differential response has been practiced here in Oregon. Generally speaking, it takes 4 to 6 years for you to see outcomes and results. And so far in Oregon, we've been able to measure a little bit in the 2-3 years we've been doing it, but it's no indication of what it can address after 4 to 6 years. So it's a little bit premature to say DR isn't working yet, because usually you have to wait 4 to 6 years to see the outcomes that DR provides. Some of the things we're looking at is how the practice is currently in Oregon. How can we, and exactly like Director Psyche has mentioned, we're looking at where we need to tweak it a little bit, where we need to change it, where we need to tailor it for Oregon's families and children. We believe if we do that and really take a good look at the way we practice DR, plus an assessment of our districts that currently don't have DR, and be very thoughtful about the rollout, we can provide something really very transformative for child welfare in Oregon.
So, Chair Steiner here, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee.
Why don't you say co-chairs and members? Yeah. Make your life a little easier.
I actually want him to keep saying my name.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't care what you think you want. You go on.
So on my way over here this morning, I kept saying to myself, Rayfield. See how successful.
See, usually
that was.
It's my name that they have trouble with, so I'm actually kind of glad.
Yeah, so you know, sometimes you just get this kind of mental block, and you know you're going to mess it up, and no matter how much you tell yourself not to, you still do. Chair Steiner Hayward and Chair Rayfield and members of the committee. So it is true that we're in the early stages of implementation, and I think I've seen the research too, and it's 4 to 6 years before you see results, but our obligation to keep children safe during that time period is no less than it is at any other given point in time. And so, you know, while we're implementing, we still have the obligation and we still have to keep children safe. And so that's the area we really have to focus on. But I just wanted to kind of share with you one piece of information about how it does work in instances, because when we asked our consultants to do an evaluation of those cases, and we have the 45 out of the 101 we have cases, we had concerns about. There was one particular one that really bothered me, and it was the one, and some of you may or may not have seen that, where we actually had rats and mice in the house, and children had suffered from rat bites, and the house was filthy, and you know, there was animal feces and all those kinds of things. And so that was one that really, in particular, bothered me quite a bit. And so I asked our consultants to follow up on that and get back to me. So on Friday, when I sat down with them, they said that, in their opinion, it wasn't that the parents were bad parents or a safety threat to the children. It was just that they were had such a multitude of issues that they were really struggling. And one of the issues they were struggling with was really extreme poverty. And so what happened in that case is that our caseworkers worked with them to really kind of give them resources, connect them with people in the community who could help them. And at this point in time, as of Friday, they reported to me that they felt pretty comfortable, that the environment had improved, and the parents were making a concerted effort with the help they were getting for the community to provide a safe environment for their children. I appreciated that, and to me it was a sign of how this could work, but I am also, in my experience, know how quickly, even if you get to a good place, it can kind of turn around on you. So I've asked our caseworkers to continue to keep eyes on this family for a period of time so we can be sure that the progress is continuing with this family.
Thank you.
Okay. Would you like the overview?
Tomorrow. Yeah. I think it just depends on how you think we're doing on time. We've got about 35 minutes left. I don't know what your plan was in terms of where to get on the slides today. How far were you hoping to get today, Ms. Al-Husseini?
We were hoping to. No. But I'm happy to go forward.
Yeah, no, if today was where you were going, then yes, please do give us the overview now.
Chair Steiner and Chair
I thought you would hope to get further today.
Actually, I think we are going to move on, and then if we have time, we can come back, or we certainly will be happy to come back in phase two for our further discussion.
Sounds good. Okay. Thank you. Right. Let's keep going.
Okay, so we are going to speak about our well-being department, which includes family foster care, which includes also our kith and kin care and certified relatives, treatment services, which include our therapeutic foster care and behavioral rehabilitation services, our independent living program, which are services to youth age 14 and over, and then the health and wellness program, which is it's a personal care program where nurses check our children when they come into care for any medical conditions, any medical needs. They train our foster parents to care for medically fragile, needy children in our care, and they conduct, you know, some of the things they do is like an annual psychotropic medication review for every child on one or more psychotropic medications. They do in-home nurse assessment. You know, basically a loose clothing physical assessment for every child as well. And our homeless and runaway youth in our services. Which was It surprises me, actually, that we are the fifth in the nation for homeless and runaway youth. And while many states are decreasing and are providing services for homeless and runaway youth, ours have increased by 2.5%.
Can I ask a clarifying question about that? Are those homeless and runaway youth who come from Oregon families, or are those homeless and runaway youth who end up in Oregon from other states, or both?
I believe, and I'll double both. It is both.
Because I do think that we see a fair number of kids ending up here from other states for a whole host of reasons. And so one wonders if some of those decreases in other states are because we see an increase here. I am certainly concerned about homeless and runaway youth who come from, and I think, just to be clear, I think it's a little problematic to lump those two together, because homeless youth may well be with their families, mm-hmm. and they may be homeless, but they're not separated from their families, which is a different issue altogether from runaway youth who have often, for understandable but very unfortunate reasons, chosen to separate themselves from their families, right? So I think a little bit more nuance about that at some point would be helpful to us, and to understand, I mean, I know that we have a huge issue with homelessness in this state, and that affects our children a lot, but that's a little different from runaways.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Wade, who's members of the committee, there was a report done last year, which I took a look at, which was really excellent.
Okay.
And kind of details who these kids are, what the needs are, what the challenges in serving them are. So we can provide that as well.
That'd be great. If you just provide that to Ms. Byerly, she can provide it to the committee. Thank you, Ms. Al-Husseini. Representative Alonso Leon.
Thank you, Chair. So this, obviously this issue is going to get worse with our housing problem, right?
Yes.
And we know it. We know, I mean, just from my experience and working in education, that while kids may not think they're homeless because they're doubling up with their family in a apartment or a home, they don't think they're homeless. And so I'm assuming that you're counting those families as well, those who double up, because for whatever reason, they're not able to afford to live independently. So when I used to work for the K-12 system, that was often happening. And I don't know if our schools necessarily always considered that as being homeless, because technically you are if you're not able to afford your own home.
Right. Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, Representative Alonso Leon. No, it does not include children who are living in their, basically in a home. I think this number, the number I mentioned, or the report that I will provide, talks about children on the streets, basically, who are homeless. One of the challenges the report quoted is there isn't one authority that deals with homeless youth in Oregon. It's between us and the Department of Education and OHA and all the other departments. And currently there isn't one lead department on. And this is all detailed in the report that I will provide.
Follow up.
Yeah, please.
So then it sounds like, depending on how you define homelessness, mm-hmm. these numbers can completely be off.
Could be low.
Yes, that is correct.
Okay.
Yeah, and it's probably low. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess, follow up. To be more accurate on the true numbers of homelessness, you have to be very specific in the definition as to what the homelessness means. In this case, but considering we have so many youth in our school systems, that I think it would be great for us to have a better understanding, and either if that definition doesn't include those kids or those families who are doubling up in homes, that we would need to include them because they have their own challenges and circumstances that come from that.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Representative Alonso Leon. Actually, I misunderstood my teammate here. They don't know if it includes.
Okay.
So I will give you all of that tomorrow, I hope.
So Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonso Leon, So about a month ago, the governor convened a group of agencies to deal with children, to sort of form a children's cabinet. There was myself, OIA, OHA, education, housing and community services, HEC, and a number of different agencies. Because I think in some cases, we're all working on children's issues, but we don't have a coordinated strategy or a lead agency. And I think this is one of the issues that I agree with you is probably not going to get better and is probably going to get worse. So we're in the stage right now of kind of identifying the issues we want to focus on moving forward and setting some priorities. And so I'm going to bring this issue to that group and to the table.
Just as a side note, this is one of the issues that I, among others, have been talking to agency directors and the governor about extensively for the past 8 to 10 months. Which is that if you look at the number of different agencies that touch the lives of children from a year prenatally to 18 years of age, I think we're up to about 10. And within each agency, I mean, just in your agency, Director Psyche, there are almost every division, except for perhaps APD, touches young children in this state. And I worry a lot about administrative inefficiency. I worry about doubling up of certain things and holes in other areas. And I'm delighted that the governor has chosen to form this children's cabinet. I've been talking with Director Psyche and with Mr. Capps, the chief education officer, and with others who are involved with this, because I share your concerns. I share the concerns that Ms. Al-Husseini raised about nobody knowing what anybody else is doing with this very vulnerable population. And we know that when we invest heavily in Oregon's children in the most efficient and evidence-based ways, we end up having a healthier state and saving money. So I'm very concerned about those as well. And I'm glad to hear from the representative.
Thank you. Chair, I was going to bring this up a little bit later in the presentation, but I think because we're having conversations about homeless youth, homeless families, I think it's a good time for me to bring this question up. We know that we have a huge immigration issue in this country. In Oregon specifically, it's become a very big issue. And when we're talking about homeless youth, potential homeless youth, potential home separated families are going to be impacted or have already been impacted with immigration raids. I'd like to know what DHS is doing, what the plans are, because, you know, it's a reality that some kids could go to school and come home and their parents are gone. And so, you know, it's going to impact our foster care system. It's going to impact our homeless youth issue that's been identified. So I'm just really curious to know what your plans are in working with families and working with the community-based programs around the state. Because I am, you know, concerned that, and this you might take this back to the children's cabinet, that we're going to have larger problems as opposed to, you know, larger problems that are being added to our system.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Representative Alonso Leon. Yes, it is something we have discussed, and we are going to stay with policy. Let's assume ICE take a parent and the children remain here. We will care for those children. and we assess the situation, and we will determine if there's a need for a placement. So we'd basically be following laws and regulations and policies. But every child who is without care, we will take care of them. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you.
Do you want to add anything?
Okay.
Ready? Yes, the next. I got my. Okay. So this slide is a little bit misleading. It looks like 2014 was a lot. the population was much higher than 2016. It's actually 200 higher, but it's when we put it in Excel, I think this is the way it came out.
Scale is a complicated problem. Scale is a very complicated problem.
But yes. As you can see, from 2014, we had 7,811 children in care. In 2015, 7,570. We went up again in 2016 to 7,600 children in care.
How does that correlate with the point that you showed us very early on about 11,000 second 2016, a total of 11,191 children spent at least one day in some type of foster care. Slide 5. Well, how do those two numbers correlate?
So
it's just a point in time as opposed to
that's your
average daily number.
Okay, as opposed to total number of kids in care over the course
of
the year. Yeah.
Just clarifying, because they're two different numbers.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify and make sure that I know you tried to explain this, but the slide, if you were to have a zero at the bottom and look over like a 5 or a 6 year period, is it basically going to fluctuate around this, or are you trying to show a trend with this? Because it's difficult to tell when it's not zeroed out, like it's kind of the...
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Wayfield, I'm not sure we can see a trend from these numbers. I mean, it fluctuates. Maybe I should bring you a longer time span for us to see if there is a trend.
And just to follow
please.
So these are just numbers. Don't read into the numbers. Don't look at the up or the down. It's more for just illustrative purposes.
Yes, it's where we are today, basically. So we do the next. This slide shows the kith and kin versus regular certification. Again, as you can see, it remains more or less the same in terms of our division. We prefer, if it's safe, relative kith and kin. If we can find family, it's always our preference.
I'm sorry, Ms. Halsey. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, keep going. It's fine.
Did you have... So our family foster care has also seen a reduction in capacity of approximately 150 families from 2014 to 2015. In 2016, we've had a slight increase, 34 families in the number of homes, but we still have a long way to go. A large portion of our certified homes are child-specific, meaning they're most likely relative certified just for specific children. Therefore, they're not open to the general population of foster children.
Senator Gilster.
Thank you. So, Ms. Halsaini, one of the really exciting messages that you sent last week is that these public service announcements are about to start yes. recruiting new foster parents into the system. Have we given you enough resource to have the certifiers that you need to certify the people that walk in the door? And if you had a magic wand, how many more certifiers would you need, and what would you need from us to be able to prepare you to succeed after hopefully Oregonians come forward and want to help with this problem?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Wayfield, Senator Gelser, that's a really wonderful question, because as you all know, we're at 82% capacity, so we need staff all across the board. For us to be successful, where's the 18% going to come from, right? So the screeners are really essential to our work. Again, I always would advocate for the staff who are working very hard, but there is so much work to be done. So I can give you a number. I can try and get you a number by tomorrow how much we need. Generally, it's 18% across the board of our current staffing level. But I can get you the screeners specifically.
And Madam Chair, I think it would be helpful that the screeners, the certifiers, if we look at that, it would be helpful to me to know both the staffing level that's funded and what you're able to hold on to because of turnover, what the vacancies are. I know that you have to advocate within the budget that's there, but as a legislator, I would like to know what you really need in terms of the number of people and the number of dollars if we were to be at 100%, because I want to be held accountable for giving you what you need. All these conversations that we have at the end of the day are about the resources and putting the right people in the right place with the right training, and you can't do that unless we give you the resources. So to the degree you can give us those numbers in terms of people and dollars, I would be really grateful.
So, Chair Steiner Hayward and Chair Rayfield, I really want to make, Senator Gelser brings up such an important point, and I really want to elaborate on that for just a sec, if I may, because we can do all the outreach and we can do all the public service announcements that we can, but if we don't have the certifier, an appropriate amount of certifiers, and it takes too long to certify a foster parent, we lose foster parents during the certification process. And the certification process is a critical step because we want to ensure that there are appropriate placement and the children will be safe there. But these are people who are in some ways making a great personal sacrifice by agreeing to do this. And if we take too long to certify them because we don't have enough certifiers, we'll lose them before we even can bring them on board. And I think that's such a critical point.
Right. Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, we also have data that I can provide for you on our workload model, what we would need as 100%. So I can provide that too.
Thank you.
Representative Buehler, and then Representative Rayfield.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. And to add to that, to fulfill the need for all the kids in the system, how many foster homes would you need, ideally? Do you know what that number is?
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Representative Buehler, I can ask and bring that to you tomorrow as well.
Representative Rayfield.
And I think to follow up on Senator Gelser's question, everybody in this room knows that we've been asked, without revenue, we're expected to manage this budget to 8% growth, which would be a cut of $285 million of existing funding. Mm-hmm. So we have to be more than just what would help the situation. How creatively can we help solve these problems within the budget framework that the big co-chairs are giving us? Because obviously we are not going to be able to fund it 100% of the workload model. And so I think thinking a little bit creatively, those are things that I know my co-chair and myself are very interested in trying to, how can we creatively do this within the confines that we have right now?
And then I have two questions. The first is with regard to the relative Kithinkin area. One of the challenges we face, and this came up in front of this subcommittee 2 years ago when Representative Stark was on, he was speaking from some personal experience, is obviously it's important for children to be with family if at all possible. However, the question then becomes if they're with close family friends whom they've known much better than people who they're technically related to by blood or marriage, how do you prioritize that? And we passed legislation at least allowing in the adoption circumstances to prioritize people who've been fostering them for a long period of time as opposed to distant relatives they don't even know. I'm interested in your thinking about how hard you look, especially in an acute need situation. And then the other piece of it is it's all very well and good to bring them in, but speaking as a former foster parent myself, and I know I'm not the only legislator who's this, supporting foster families and giving them the training that they need and the resources that they need to be great foster parents is the other piece of this. And I would ask the same question that my colleagues have asked in terms of if you could design the right, what states are doing this right in terms of ongoing support and training of foster families to ensure that they have the resources that they need, not just physical resources, but emotional, educational resources they need to be great foster parents.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, this is a priority for us, is how we support foster families. And we're going to talk about it a little bit with the app, but there's a lot we should be doing. So I totally agree with you. Thank you for that.
And with regard to the relative question?
With exactly what you stated, with adoptions after a year, a non-familiar member becomes equal to a familiar member, I can ask Laurie, if you don't mind coming up, if you want to speak a little bit more about Kithinkin.
Okay. Well, thank you. Yeah. Don't get me wrong, I understand the priority of how the value of keeping kids with family, but being with familiar people is also...
No.
Especially in the traumatic time of being separated from your parents.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, my name is Lori Price for the record. I'm the Deputy Director of the Child Welfare Program. In response to your question about how hard or far we look for family, kith and kin. That's our priority number one upon bringing any child into care. We want to minimize the trauma on that child, and we do that by finding any resource that is known to the child that's willing and able to care safely for the child. We have policy that allows for an expedited certification, because we do certify all homes that we place a child in, but all families, whether they're kith or kin or a general foster care applicant, are required to go through the full certification process. But we do have an expedited process that allows us to place more urgently with a family member or a family friend known to the child.
But to play devil's advocate for a minute, if I could, Ms. Price, a family is determined to not provide a safe environment for their children, and they have across the street neighbors who have kids the same age who've grown up, and giving you sort of an extreme scenario, but they have across the street neighbors, kids have grown up together, they all know each other well, they're back and forth to their houses a lot, and those across the street neighbors are in fact more than capable of providing a safe and nurturing environment for those children, and there's a distant sibling of the parents or some other relative. How do you prioritize in that case? I mean, somebody who's kith or kin and really has not been integrally involved with those children's lives, as opposed to somebody who has been integrally involved, I could make a pretty good argument that it's the same place that we're at with the law that we passed 2 years ago to give foster parents who've had custody of these children for a year equal priority with family members. Could you talk about that a little bit, please?
Absolutely. Chair Senator Hayward, Chair Rayfield, members of the committee, it's always our priority, again, to minimize the trauma to the child. So we would be looking initially for the most urgent placement. We would be looking for what would be the closest, what would keep the child in their school of origin, what would keep them close to their family as we work with that family for reunification. At whatever point that we understand that we're not going to be able to reunify with family, we may do a broader search.
Got it.
For a different type of placement.
Okay. Thank you. We've got about 10, 12 more minutes, so okay. You guys decide based on where you think is going to be a natural break point.
Right. Yeah. And I'm very lucky to have Lori here because she oversees behavior rehabilitation services. So our behavior rehabilitation services really are, yeah, as you can read, it's a higher level of care that provides the necessary services to children with severe emotional and behavioral challenges to return home. As of mid-2016, we had lost around 38 BRS beds, behavior rehabilitation beds, and we have built, we've gained 61 beds, so therefore we have a net growth of 23 beds. We're actively asking, we have proposals out there for any agencies who are interested to work with us and partner with us to serve this population. More than 310 children in care per day receive these important services, which includes behavioral intervention, counseling, and skill building services in professional assessment and stabilization facilities, therapeutic foster care, and residential placement models. These service programs are administered through contracts with licensed private child caring agencies. So at any given day during 2016, we had 172 children in professional shelter programs and 143 children in residential treatment setting. And I don't know if you have any more questions.
Senator Gelser.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Alassani, I was really surprised over the last couple of years to learn how our BRS system is built. I had always imagined it as a system that was primarily built and staffed by social workers, mental health professionals, and was surprised to find that that's where you've got your farm homes and Kairos that do have that medical oversight. But it seems the majority of the programs don't offer direct mental health services or even have bachelor degreed people that are providing the primary staff. As you're rebuilding, what do you see as the future of BRS and the workforce that's needed and the types of programs that are needed to be built to meet the needs of the kids that need that high level of care today?
That's right. Chair,
Okay. Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Senator Gels, a great question. Thank you for that. I agree with you. I think we have a long way to go with our BRS providers. My understanding, and Lori oversees our BRS programming, but I believe we do not currently, we are not the ones who provide mental health services. I believe that's through OHA, is that correct? But I agree with you. There's a lack of services, number one. I think there's definitely a lack of standardization across the board to the level of care that we provide. I believe we should have more clinical oversight. We currently partner well with OHA, to be honest, but I think there's a lot of scope for us to grow there and to provide much more services. One of the things Laurie and I have been doing is reaching out to community organizations, a sort of understanding what they can offer. So we have like a capacity assessment exercise we're going through right now to understand what they have. And once we do that, we're going to try and figure out a way to use that to bolster what we have in our BRS system currently. But I agree with you. And if you have something to add.
I do, if you don't mind. Thank you, co-chairs and Senator Gelser. The distinct difference between the two levels of care that you're describing is one is psychiatric residential treatment services, and that is paid for and owned by the Oregon Health Authority, and children have to meet diagnostic criteria to enter that type of 24-hour lockdown residential care. Behavioral rehabilitative services are for children that don't have a diagnosis that warrants ongoing mental health care. We get in these push-pull conversations quite a bit about why children are behavioral. But for the behavioral rehabilitative level of care, we currently have therapeutic foster care. We do have some residential care, and we're actively working with the OHA to be able to provide those wraparound services for children in their homes of origin, which is one of those creative solutions that you've asked for.
And then just a quick follow-up. When looking at kind of rebuilding the BRS system and that design, kind of rebuilding the beds that have been lost, what do you see as the future? You've got programs like Maple Star that do their kind of therapeutic foster care, and kids are in family homes rather than in more institutional congregate settings. Do you see a future that's more focused on congregate care or in the therapeutic foster homes? And then the second question, just because language matters, has there been any discussion about changing the name behavioral rehabilitation services? Because for a youth who has been traumatized and is expressing trauma through behavior, it just seems like the focus is on this kid is broken and we're going to make them less bad by putting them in the system.
Chair Steiner Hayward, Chair Rayfield, Senator Gelser, I totally agree with you. We should come up with a different title for this department, because I agree with you. It already frames a child in a certain way once they enter BRS, just by the word. And names and words matter, so I agree with you with that. In terms of how we're going forward, we're trying to sort of make it very tailor it to the community. What works best for our kids? What would keep our kids safer? So some of the what we're doing right now is we are working with our community providers to sort of understand where they are, what they have, what capacity building exercise do they need, how can we help them get to where they need to be, and then really look at different ways. It's not one size fits all, obviously, and there might be things we're not even looking at in terms of services for this population. But we are partnering with community organizations at the moment to understand what they can offer, and then working with like the Casey Foundation and other sort of national experts in this field to help us think, to look at other models across the country, what has worked and what hasn't worked. For us, all suggestions are on the table. We want to provide better services and to keep these kids safe, but we also want to empower their families as well. So I agree with you. Yes, we have a long way to go. And do you have more to add?
Co-chair Senator Gelser. The only thing I would add is it's named after the state plan amendment that allows us to do that work. I don't disagree with you. Language absolutely matters, but it's named after the program, and we'll work with our Medicaid partners to make sure that if we call it something different, we still get the federal support to provide those services to children.
Thank you. Okay, if we're good on that, I think we're starting into a new section. The next slide. Right? I think maybe we'll just call it a day there. Any final words for today that you want to
Thank you so much.
Anything else from the committee, Ms. Byerly? Tomorrow, day two of child welfare, same bat time, same bat channel, and we're adjourned. Okay.